Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their yearly Writers Conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, speaking of writing, if you were to look up publishing and Publishing Insider in the dictionary, you might find a picture of my guest today, Mr. Donald Moss. He has worn many hats in his publishing career. He actually did some ghostwriting once upon a time. He was an editor. Now he is the head of his own literary agency, the Donald Moss Agency. But he also is a teacher. He is a lecturer and a pretty good writer, too. And he's written many books for writers about writing and publishing. Most recently, writing 21st century fiction, but many of you may know him from writing the breakout novel, which I know at least one writer who cites as the reason her career went from being a rather middling one to being a bestseller. So all this is great, but I have to tell you, one of the reasons I'm so glad to have him on the show today is I think that on top of knowing a lot about the publishing industry and having a lot of great things to say about it, he is ultimately an optimist. And in my opinion, a friend to writer, and really looks out for writers and wants the best for them. And that, for me, is the kind of literary agent I would want on my side, and also the kind of literary agent I want on my show. So let's get him on here. Don, how are you doing? You're on the show.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. Last time we talked, let's see, it was at the Pacific Northwest last summer conference. You and I were chatting about this and that. You mentioned to me you were doing a session with Vogel, weren't you? The Hero's Journey guy. Is this correct?
Yes, that's right. In fact, it happened last November in Seattle. Christopher Vogler, author of The Writer's Journey, myself, and another very, very popular author of books on the fiction of craft, or the craft of fiction, James Scott Bell.
Yeah.
The three of us got together to do a workshop called Story Masters. We each taught a day, teaching the different things that we teach. And then on the final day, we got together to do a scene-by-scene breakdown with clips from the movie to show how The Hunger Games worked as a story. Chris from his point of view, Jim from his point of view, and me from mine. So we really dove into that popular bestseller to show that it's many, many, many things. It's a beautifully crafted book that works on so many levels, and we were illuminating those. And it was a wonderful workshop, and I always learn things from those guys, and the participants seem to get a lot out of it too. So it was a pretty exciting event. We do it annually, and we're doing it again this November in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a great teacher. I have to say that the first writing conference I ever went to, you were there at that conference, and I went to a session you taught, and I still remember some of the advice you offered that day. And when I teach, I still will mention that. And the two pieces that stick out in my head, two pieces of advice. The first was that, I hope this is still true of agents, I'm pretty sure it is, that the agents don't want a book, they want a career. And the other, and I think this is really true, and I think it's still true, I don't care about social media, as useful as it is, that most books are still sold or become a breakout because of word of mouth, of one person taking another person and saying, here, you've got to read this book, that's what really makes it happen. Do you still feel that those are true today?
Those are absolutely still true. When you were talking about fiction, really, for agents, it's developing a career that's profitable. You know, when you're doing a contract for books 17, 18, and 19 in a series, or something like that, that's when it's really sweet.
Yeah.
In terms of word of mouth, word of mouth is still the number one and best way to win new readers. It's word of mouth now includes, you know, some online iterations of that.
Sure.
But, that, however, does pale in comparison to the number one reason people buy fiction, which is that they're already fans of a given author.
Right.
Most sales, 2/3 of sales, are really to existing fans. But if you're a new author, or if you're trying to grow your audience, which most authors want to do, there are a lot of things that work, but all incrementally, all in small ways. The thing that really works is personal recommendation, what we call word of mouth.
Yeah, I think so, because one of the things I've always felt fiction is up against in marketing itself, unlike, say, film, is that a film can show you a 3-minute teaser and you actually see what's in the movie, albeit, you know, cut and shaped for that little 3 minutes, but you still get to see what the movie looks like and hear what it sounds like in some way. And so you get an actual taste in a very short snippet. With a book, you can't do that. You can see the cover, maybe the person picks it up and reads the first page, but it's hard to give a person a feel of what it is until they've actually hunkered down and gotten a taste of the voice and know what it is. And so for that reason, I still think the recommendation remains one of the best selling points for fiction.
Well, what it really does is lower consumer resistance. I mean, you know, we, as consumers of anything, and this is true of books as well, we don't want to try new things. I mean, you know, we don't want to necessarily spend our money unless we're really convinced.
Right.
The personal recommendation breaks down that resistance. Not always, but it's very, very helpful.
Yeah.
If I recommend a particular automobile tire to you, you know, I say, you really, really, really got to get this radial tire, Bill. You know, I don't have a car, which you should take into consideration, but still, it does do something.
All right. So writing 21st century fiction, how is that different from writing 20th century fiction?
Well, what a good question. The answer has to do with something that really caused me to write the book in the first place, which was a observation I made about the New York Times bestseller list over the last couple of years. You know, we've been in a recession here in this country. Perhaps you've noticed that. The last 4 years have been pretty flat.
I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, a lot of things have changed, and consumers have been kind of tight with their money. That's true with book sales as well, and you can really see it on the New York Times bestseller list, which is the most comprehensive, reliable, and widely watched list there is. Now, if you look at the hardcover New York Times bestseller list, it looks kind of like you would expect it to look. I mean, there are brand name authors there and a lot of thrillers and so forth. But what's changed is that column in tiny type that you see on that list. It's a list of numbers, and it tells you how many weeks a particular title has been on the New York Times bestseller list. Back in the day, blockbuster books could sell for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, months. Nowadays, those numbers are single digits.
I know.
You know, 3, 4, 5 on the upcoming New York Times list for this coming weekend. It's there are a couple of books that have been there like 8 and 10, and one book 14 weeks. But that's pretty unusual. Small, brief bursts of really intense sales for some very popular authors, and then those books stop selling at that kind of rate. Meanwhile, over on the trade paperback list, where books backlist, that books don't live forever in hardcover if they're going to stay alive in the bookstore for a long time. It's in paperback, right? Well, on the trade paperback list is a whole category of books that where the numbers, weeks on sale on the bestseller list, are like 78 weeks.
Yeah.
89 weeks, 111 weeks. There's a whole category of books that's been selling at blockbuster levels for 1 to 2 or more years. And get this, all of these books, with one exception, are books that were originally categorized as literary fiction.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Yep. We were talking about books like The Help, The Art of Racing in the Rain, like Water for Elephants.
Little B. Right,
Little B, Sarah's Key, books like this. people sometimes pejoratively call it lit light or women's fiction or things like that, which sort of, you know, in an attempt to explain it away and make it okay that literary fiction actually sold that well.
Right.
You know, there's some sort of mitigating factor there to salve your ego or whatever. But the fact is that many, 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 many people have enjoyed these books. There aren't enough book clubs in the world. There aren't, you know, the movies come much later.
Yeah.
Nothing explains the success of these books except what's inside those covers. Now, what's inside, which I'll get to in just a sec, is the same thing that is also allowing some category writers, genre writers of different sorts, to break, as we say in the industry, out of category, that is, to sell significantly better than other writers of their type. What's going on? What's it all about? What happens in all of these books is that they marry a great story and beautiful writing. They bring those things together. What's happening in the 21st century is a breakdown, first of all, a breakdown of category lines. We see this in blended genres and genre bending. There's a lot of this going on. Even literary writers are borrowing tropes from other kinds of literature, time travel, and, you know, whatnot.
There's a lot of going on.
Absolutely. So what that tells me is that writers themselves are gathering their influence and their techniques from a variety of places, and at the same time they're bringing to their writing, you know, literary values, which make it a very rich and powerful reading experience. You get all that stuff together, and you've got 21st century fiction, which is great stories and beautiful writing that are ignore genre boundaries and sort of take everything that's available to writers from literature, from our history, and use it more as a toolbox than as a container, you know?
Yeah.
So writing 21st century fiction is really about how to break out of whatever box you may start out in, find your own very unique voice and way of writing, but also to, if you're a more literary sort of writer, to work with story events. You know, not that, you know, for literary writers, very dirty word, plot.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about.
Of course I do.
Yeah, right. But conversely, if you're working in with a more commercial intent, you're some sort of crime writer or you know, a fantasist of some kind.
Right.
You may think beautiful writing. Oh, please spare me. You know, I'm a storyteller. I laugh all the way to the bank.
Okay.
Well, beautiful writing is not just beautiful imagery. All the pretty words that you know we kind of think of as literary writing. It's a lot of things. It's a lot of techniques.
All right, I got to step in here for just a second because I agree, and this is always one of my frustrations about the concept of beautiful writing. So if I come from a place, it's from the world of literature for sure and poetry. That's really where I grew out of as a writer. And what I've come to understand is that what is called beautiful writing is accurate writing, writing that says precisely what the artist feels, sees, hears, tastes, what it feels in particular. And the beauty comes from the accuracy with which the thought, which is often the actual beautiful thing, is represented. It's not just about being the cleverest guy in the class or the wittiest. It's rendering, if you want to read, Anna Stothard just published a book called The Pink Hotel. She is so precise, so accurate. And yes, she's a good, clever writer, but she brings it to life with accuracy, with precision, with detail. So there, I got that off my chest. Now you can...
Well, I agree with you, and I also think, though, that beautiful writing is writing that conveys meaning and purpose. That there's, when you're reading a novel, you have a sense that there's a reason you're reading it. It's stirring you. It's making you think and feel things that you didn't before. It has a resonant echo, a sense that there's something at work under the surface here. But that feeling that you get when you read comes from techniques that authors use, associative techniques like symbols and parallels and reversals and things that anybody can do, and good writers of any intent, you know, do, sometimes consciously, sometimes not, in their fiction. So identifying those things and, using them, whatever kind of writer you are, is really what writing 21st century fiction is all about.
Absolutely, you know, and I'm seeing more and more literary writers letting themselves, I mean, it's not very like they've never let themselves tell a story, but there was a period, I think, in the world of literature where the style became, and particularly when postmodernism got really, you know, in metafiction really took off, where it became as much about the writer as the story. And and I think that was big for a while, and I think that seems to be dialing back some now, and I think all for the better, because the story is there for the reader. The story is there for the reader, and the writer uses their writing to tell that story so that the reader can feel what the story has to share. And that resonance you talk about, to me, is always present in the best fiction, and it is the question of, it's not just that I have caught the bad guy, but what did I learn about myself, the hero,
right,
the process of catching the, what was discovered about life? It's not, you know, so for instance, I write memoir, and, or I've just finished a memoir, and I learned big time that you, it's never about me, it's about what my life revealed about life, not about Bill. You know, I think that's true of even of the characters in the stories. What does it reveal about life?
That's right. I mean, commercial fiction that has a really high impact not only, you know, tells a story, has a plot, but takes a character on a transformative journey from, you know, from one state of being to another. I mean, you know, it always transforms, you know, an individual. Literary fiction, too, externalizes what's going on inside and makes it dramatic and outward. You know, with a lot of writers who've been highly, highly successful, it's really hard to say, are they literary writers or commercial writers or what? I mean, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, is that literary fiction or science fiction? Time Traveler's Wife, same thing.
Right.
In the realm of thrillers, Philip Kerr, is he a literary writer or a thriller writer? You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is that they have told powerful stories using the tools they needed to say something that we'll never forget.
That's right. That's right. And the thing is that, I mean, obviously, as an agent, your job is to sell books to publishers and to get the best deal you can for your writers. And part of the tool of selling is being able to categorize it, I assume, for the editors so they can picture what it is and where it's going to go and how they're going to sell it. And that's all part of the business of writing. But for the writer, they're just a person who wants to tell a story. And the idea of that box is actually artificial. It's a necessary artificial, but it's not real.
I think it's a danger, that box. If you identify yourself as some kind of category writer, you're automatically in a box. And what that means is that you're going to, you know, honor the traditions and what's great about the literature you love, which is fine. But it also means that you're going to reach for, stereotypical characters and story tropes that are fine and may serve the genre, but don't necessarily serve you and your intent. So, you know, I think it's important to really think out of that box, to break that box, and really become your own writer, no matter where you start, or what your influences are, or your style, or your way of working, or whatever it is you want to say.
Well, absolutely, because as an agent, you know, you want a voice that's original, and the way it seems to me an author will have an original voice is not by looking around and saying, well, what hasn't someone done? But by saying, what would please me the most? How do I most want to tell this story? And if that lands somewhere outside of what the genre is supposed to do, I say all the better. That's what William Gibson said when I interviewed him. And Gibson, you know, he was so frustrated that he ever got labeled a science fiction writer. He didn't want to be a science, but that's what he did. But he said, you know, get out, let yourself be outside of it. You know, he saw only benefits in it. And I agree, I think, because if it's authentic to the writer, then now you've changed the genre, probably, maybe.
Well, there's the writing, and then there's the publishing and the retailing of a story. When writers, I strongly feel like you, that, you know, you don't want to be constrained in any way. But when it comes to publishing, we still live in a retail landscape that trucks in categories. And, you know, while we don't love them, you know, there is a convenience for retailers and to some extent for consumers as well. And publishers know that, so they have to break books into some broad categories, you know, package them and label them and put them in their catalogs and so forth in such a way that people, you know, have a basic idea of what these books are and to whom they're first going to appeal.
Yeah.
So Bill Gibson and you know, any number of other writers have had to start somewhere, and one of my jobs is to sort of decide where this crazy, you know, mashup that somebody's written,
right.
You know, actually is going to find its first and most appreciative readers in what section of a physical retail bookstore, because that determines the imprints that, you know, might be best for it and the publisher, you know, the editors that we might want to submit to and so forth. But when fiction is highly, highly successful, what happens is that it reaches readers beyond that section of the bookstore.
Yeah.
It breaks demographic lines. It breaks international lines. I mean, it every really, truly powerful author finds their own unique audience. It may be heavy with readers of one genre, but it's not ever going to be perfectly, you know, contained in that box or in that section of the bookstore. And that's the way it should be, you know. Readers are a lot more flexible than, you know, the industry thinks, but you do have to start somewhere. And so,
yeah,
you know, you wind up being called a science fiction writer, even though that may not be what you actually are.
You do have to start somewhere. I think about... it's a funny story. So we mentioned Art of Racing in the Rain. So that's Garth Stein. It was his third novel. Second novel was called How Evan Broke His Head, I think. And the first novel, I forget the name of it now. I actually helped him. We did an interview about it after the fact, because when that book came out, they marketed it as horror. And it involved, you know, these spirit ravens and this sort of Tlingit mythology. So it had a kind of, you know, ghosts and spirits in there, but anybody who knows Garth Stein knows horror is not what he writes exactly.
No, he writes talking horror. Dying dogs.
That's exactly. That's his thing. It's, you know, it's spirituality. So, but they marketed it as horror, and it did not do very well, lo and behold.
No.
That's all they could think.
You know. Well, you know, yes, the publishing in that way really does have its limitations, but I believe that great novels do find their audience. You know, not that publishing can't mess it up or get in the way or, you know, accidents happen or things, you know, things glitch up. For whatever reasons, that does happen. But, you know, there's so many stories. Here's a story. You mentioned Little B before.
Yeah.
That too, was a third novel. That author... his second book, and I'm going to blank on the name of that book too.
In the Area, I think it was called.
Or perhaps it was one before that. But in any event, it was one of his previous novels was about a terrorist attack in London. And it happened to be published on the day of some bombings in the underground and on a bus there. Waterston's, the main bookstore chain, pulled the book from the shelves because of that. After it had been on sale for a couple of hours, and it was pulled from the shelves.
Oh, God.
Well, what happened was the book was later re-released. I mean, it was reshipped and reshelved.
Yeah.
And it actually did reasonably well. It found its audience. It was appreciatively reviewed and everything. And the guy went on and he finally wrote Little B, an enormous international bestseller.
Yeah.
Didn't
yeah.
slow him down, really, you know. So I don't really believe that. I really don't think that it's the fault of publishing or retailing or anything that I really think good stories prevail. I really believe that.
I agree, and that's why I think it's so important for writers. It's good to know about the publishing world and to not be naive about it.
Yeah.
And to learn the business, it's not that hard to learn, I don't think, in a certain way, especially if you get an agent who can take care of a lot of the details of it. But your job is to tell a really good story, and you've got to trust in the world that it wants good stories.
I want
a good story.
Yes.
You want a good story. The world wants good stories. Don't sing that sad song of, well, no, good stories aren't getting published anymore. It's just all this crap. I don't even want to hear.
No, that's baloney. That's baloney.
Yeah.
That is just not true. In fact, fiction really leads a lot of other media. It's a groundbreaking, you know, cutting edge medium, even though people think of it as antique and old media and so forth. It's not like that at all. Fiction is more important than it's ever been. Look, think of it this way. Fiction has actually changed the world in centuries and decades past, and you know what? It's going to do that again in this century, in this decade. Count on it. Maybe fiction that doesn't come from the United States, maybe fiction that comes from elsewhere, but believe me, fiction has transformative power in the world, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Oh, absolutely, because, that great quote, I'm blanking on the poet's name now, but she said, shoot, I can't remember her name. It's a great one. I've said it before, but for human beings, the universe is not made of atoms, but of very small stories. And I don't even think that's a joke. I think human beings, that is absolutely true. Our lives, we may have flesh and blood, but we are made of stories, and stories are more important to us than anything else. The story you tell about your life is your life. You change that story, you change your life.
And it's coded into us. The hero's journey recurs in culture after culture after culture throughout history. It's fundamental. It's the glue that holds us together. It was around the campfire, in the Mastodon days, and it is today, too.
Oh, absolutely. And think even about popular culture. People always sort of bow down to movies, but think of some of the biggest series out there have been from film, in terms of Twilight, The Hunger Games, Lord of the Rings. These are all books, and even the superhero things came from comic books, which is another form of publishing,
which were themselves an homage to early science fiction.
It's true because I'll tell you, I have friends in the film and television industry, and it is a hell of a lot easier to get a book published than to get a movie made or to get a television series made. It takes so many moving parts to get people to say yes. I'm going to spend the $100 million to do this. Get a book published. I remember when I interviewed Nora Ephron, she said, it doesn't take much compared to me making one of my movies. It's a much simpler affair.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and an important one, too. So I'm not despairing at all of our industry. I think it's exciting. I think it's growing. It's healthy. All the new things that are happening, the rise of e-books and e-readers, it's good. It's all very, very good for us.
And so we were just talking earlier, and we don't have but a couple minutes, but you are not afraid of the e-book, is that right? You don't fear the e-book?
There's this notion that e-books are somehow subversive, that they're, tearing down the print book industry. That's actually the reverse is true. E-books have actually helped the print book industry. They've been a bright spot and a profit center in the recessionary years that we've just been through. They're another way to reach readers, and they're working very, very well for print authors. And they're even, in some cases, not that many if you ask me, but in some cases working well for indie authors who, use e-books as a launching pad. I think it's a really, really hard way to go, but they've been good all around. I think it's a terrific enhancement of and great new way to get books to readers.
Yeah, especially for these authors. Probably you work with a lot of genre authors who maybe have some great stories out of print. You put them up on ebook for almost nothing, and suddenly these books that were making these authors nothing are now finding readers again in ebook.
Astonishing. You should see some of the royalty statements we get on 30-year-old titles.
Yeah.
They have a heck of a lot of life left in them. Authors are, I represent one author who's making six figures a year from 30-year-old books.
I love it. I love it. Well, Don, I knew it would be over too fast, and it is. Thank you so much. Always, always good to talk to you. Always good to hear what you have to say about the world of writing, publishing, anything else.
Oh, Bill, it's great to talk to you. I look forward to the next time.
Okay, good luck with all your stuff, and to all you writers out there, remember, keep your hope alive. Write a good story. Write the story you love any way you want, as well as you can. There is a place for it. Maybe you're going to indie publish it. Maybe you'll find a great agent like Donald, and he'll find a great publisher. There's a lot of ways to do it, but just do what you love, and as far as I have seen, you really can't go wrong. So next week I'm off, but the week after that, I'm going to be with the great Michael Neal. Ooh, you're going to want to see that one. Until then, have fun. Enjoy yourself.